Good day, and welcome to the Immunic Therapeutics conference call. Update on the preclinical and clinical development of IMU-935. All participants will be in a listen-only mode. Should you need assistance, please signal a conference specialist by pressing the star key followed by zero. After today's presentation, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. To ask a question, you may press star then one. Please note this event is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to Jessica Breu. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Paul. Also from my side, a very warm welcome to Immunic's IMU-935 R&D Day. My name is Jessica Breu, Head of Investor Relations and Communications at Immunic. The purpose of today's call is to discuss our newly released preclinical data for IMU-935, a highly potent and selective inverse agonist of the transcription factor RORγt, and to provide an update on IMU-935's clinical development strategy and the potential treatment for psoriasis and metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer. Speaking on today's webcast from Immunic are Dr. Daniel Vitt, Chief Executive Officer and President, Dr. Hella Kohlhof, Chief Scientific Officer, and Dr. Andreas Müller, Chief Medical Officer. We also warmly welcome our scientific guest speaker, Dr. Tuning Sun, Department of Molecular Imaging and Therapy, City of Hope. We extend our thanks to Dr. Sun for participating in today's event. During today's presentation, you will have the opportunity to ask questions in two Q&A sessions. Our operator, Cole, will handle the incoming questions. Before we begin, I would like to remind you that this presentation may contain forward-looking statements. Such statements can be identified by words such as may, will, expect, anticipate, estimate, or words with a similar meaning, and such statements involve a number of risks and uncertainties that could cause Immunic's actual results to differ materially from those discussed here. Please note that these forward-looking statements reflect Immunic's opinion only as of the date of this presentation, and it undertakes no obligation to revise or publicly release the result of any revision to these forward-looking statements in light of new information or future events. Please refer to Immunic's SEC filings for a more detailed description of the risk factors that may affect Immunic's results and these forward-looking statements. I would now like to turn the call over to our CEO and President, Dr. Daniel Vitt.
Yes, thank you, Jessica. As you can see from the agenda slide we have prepared for today, there's a lot of exciting things to share with you today from different aspects regarding IMU-935. I think for the company it's an important day, and I'm very happy that you're on the call today with us. I think you will see a couple of interesting new features on 935 and also an update on the status of the program. At Immunic, we are developing a pipeline of selective oral drugs for aiming at offering patients with chronic inflammatory and autoimmune diseases new and clinically meaningful treatment options. We're currently actively developing three clinical stage projects. IMU-838 is our lead molecule. 2 weeks ago, we announced that we received clearance by the FDA and EMA to proceed with our clinical phase III trial in RMS and a supportive phase II clinical trial in progressive MS. Another program, IMU-856, is a molecule targeting a new mode of action, aiming for restoration of intestinal barrier function without impairing the immune system. IMU-856 is currently tested in a clinical phase I trial. Today the focus is on IMU-935, an orally available inhibitor of IL-17 secretion. As already said, we have a very exciting program prepared for you today, including one of the key scientific experts in the field of RORγt biology, Professor Tuning Sun from City of Hope in California. Okay, let's start with a little bit of an overview on IL-17 landscape. IL-17 family cytokines were found to play an important role in the pathogenesis of various autoimmune and chronic inflammatory diseases. Over the last couple of years, antibodies targeting this axis have been approved for treating patients suffering from diseases like psoriasis and RA and so forth. These antibodies corroborate IL-17's role in autoimmune diseases, but are more complex, costly, and less patient-friendly than oral drugs. Therefore, it is Immunic's goal to develop an orally available and potent IL-17 inhibitor for the safe and efficacious treatment of autoimmune diseases. The protein Rho gamma T was found to play a key role in Th17 differentiation and IL-17 cytokine secretion, and therefore is perceived to be a good target for an oral IL-17 inhibitor. At Immunic, we aim to develop a small molecule inhibitor of the pathologic functions of Rho gamma T in autoimmune diseases without affecting physiological function of Rho gamma T. Several companies and academic groups have worked on finding selective Rho gamma T inhibitors. However, selectivity seems to be a major challenge. In a recent review, only a small series of oral Rho gamma T inhibitors, or more precisely inverse agonists, were reported to be in active development. Just very recently, for example, AbbVie announced that their Rho gamma T inverse agonist, Sidorogant, is planned to be tested in phase 2 clinical trial in patients with plaque psoriasis. I think this nicely outlines the need for selective oral Rho gamma T inhibitors, which have the potential to establish a new oral inhibitor of IL-17 and thus suppressing the Th17 axis in patients suffering from autoimmune diseases and chronic inflammatory diseases. Given the strong medical need, I'm happy to hand over to our R&D leadership team, Dr. Hella Fulov, Scientific Officer at Immunic, and followed by Andreas Müller, who is our Chief Medical Officer. Both are co-founders of Immunic. I'm also very pleased, as Jessica already said in the beginning, that we have Professor Julian Sun, one of the leading scientists in this emerging field of Rho gamma T biology, as an external speaker with us later on this call today, to give more detailed insights why and how IMUN95 may change the field of going forward for an oral IL-17 inhibitor. And with this, I would like to hand over to Hella.
Thank you very much, Tim. So I will talk about the background of the target Rho gamma T and IMUN935 as an inhibitor here. Rho gamma T has three main functions, which are Th17 differentiation, cytokine production for IL-17A and IL-17F, and thymocyte maturation, meaning early T-cell selection and development within the thymus. IMUN935, as an inverse agonist of Rho gamma T, is able to inhibit differentiation towards Th17 cells, as well as the production of IL-17A and IL-17F. But it allows the physiological maturation of T-cells within the thymus, what is needed for normal thymus, for a normal T-cell repertoire to fight against diseases. IMUN935 is very potent on human cells, and we were able to demonstrate this in stimulated human PBMCs, where IMUN935 inhibits the production of autoimmune disease-relevant cytokines, IL-17A and IL-17F, with IC50 values of 4 to 5 nanomolar. On the right, you see the co-crystal structure of a closely related derivative compound and how it binds to the orthosteric binding site of the Rho gamma ligand binding domain. On the left, we show that IMUN935 is able to inhibit Th17 differentiation with an IC50 of 135 nanomolar when tested in primary murine cells in vitro. On the right, you see the dose response curve for IL-17F production with human-stimulated PBMC. In the human test system, IMUN935 strongly inhibits the production of IL-17F in a dose-dependent fashion with an EC50 of 2 nanomolar and an EC90 of around 6 nanomolar. To demonstrate IMUN935's impact on inflamed skin tissue as an ex vivo model for psoriasis, we used human skin punches, which were stimulated with the pro-inflammatory cytokine cocktail and treated in parallel with IMUN935. Again, IMU935 was extremely potent to suppress the release of IL-17A and IL-17F and reduce as well the release of psoriasis-relevant cytokines like GM-CSF and IL-22. Next, we investigated IMU935 in a graft versus host disease mouse model using human PBMC for simulation to be as close as possible to human conditions. The human graft versus host disease is an immune condition that occurs after transplant procedures when immune cells from the donor, the so-called graft cells, attack the recipient patient host tissue, for example lung, gut, and liver. The disease is a side effect that is common after bone marrow stem cell transplantations. Here we used irradiated immunocompromised mice that received human PBMC as a so-called graft, triggering the disease. Animals were treated in parallel with IMU935. IMU935 reduced the severity of the disease in this graft versus host model. And on the left, you see that this activity was most likely due to a reduction of the number of circulating human CD45 cells, so CD4 and CD8 positive cells. When we investigated the impact on the gut as a target organ for toxicity and disease severity driven by the graft cells, we saw what is depicted on the right, that IMU935 was able to prevent hypoplasia and apoptosis in epithelial foot cells of the gut and reduces or even prevents the immune cell infiltration in the lamina propria and the mesentery. With raw gamma T as a target and its inhibition, there has been a challenge due to a potential risk for T-cell lymphomas. In several publications, knockout of raw gamma T in mice was shown to correlate with a potential risk for T-cell lymphoma. Muntermeyer et al. In 2017 have shown that some small molecule inhibitors of raw gamma T, developed for example by Novartis and GSK, showed thymic aberration in rats. Due to safety findings seen in animal studies by several pharma companies, some of the development projects were stopped or switched to alternative chemotypes. But with a publication by He et al. In 2017, it was shown for the first time that raw gamma T function can be uncoupled with regard to Th17 differentiation and thymocyte maturation. Mutation studies showed that minimal changes in the protein sequence can lead to variable contributions to different phenotypes. For example, the change of leucine 93 to alanine leads to loss of Th17 differentiation capacity but maintains thymocyte maturation physiological function. I'm very proud to have here with us today one of the leading experts in the field of raw gamma T biology and the senior author of this paradigm-shifting publication, Professor Dominic Sun from the Department of Molecular Imaging and Therapy from City of Hope. With this, I would like to hand over to Professor Sun.
Hi, thanks Dan and Hila for your nice introduction, which will save me some time on introduce the IMU935, our gamma T inhibitor. A little bit about myself. When I was a postdoc fellow, I basically first knocked out our gamma T gene in the mice and demonstrate its function in stem cell development. And when I established my independent lab, I spent like next 20 years studying this molecule. So we know a lot about this molecule. And so as Hela has mentioned, this potential issue with our gamma T inhibitor is the lymphoma. We know that our gamma T has two functions. One is Th17 differentiation, and the other is the stem cell development. So our gamma T inhibitor, although can prevent Th17-dependent autoimmunity, However, it can also interfere stem-cell development, which eventually lead to systemic lymphoma, which is demonstrated by the Novartis publication with their R-gamma-T inhibitor. So the question is it possible to have an R-gamma-T inhibitor specifically targeting Th17 cell, but does not affect stem-cell function? This is the time that Immunix come to us, ask us to test AMU-935. At first, we want to confirm AMU-935 actually inhibits Th17 function, basically Th17 depreciation. We show that it can inhibit Th17 function in a dose-dependent manner. On the left panel, you can see when we use a T cell that have our gamma T knockout, they don't form L17 producing Th17 cell. If you look at the percentage of the L17 positive cell in the right circle, and within this our gamma T knockout T cell, we can introduce wild type our gamma T and then rescue the production of L17. You can see this is a rescue population in the second panel. And in the third panel, if we add additional AMU-935, you can see it can prevent L17 production. And the next panel basically is to summarize of the three panels on the left. And the last panel, basically we're using different concentrations of AMU-935, you can see the concentration-dependent inhibition of the production of L17. So, in the previous study, we only detected one gene, which is L17. However, it is, you know, our gamma T regulates many other genes critical for Th17 differentiation. Th17 differentiation is a program. It's not only one gene can regulate Th17 deficiency. There are many other genes. So in here, we use RNA-seq to analyze the cell that either is the wild-type cell or the wild cell treated with AMU-35. So if you look at this on the left side, those are genes in red inhibited by AMU-935. These are all Th17 genes, Th17 signature genes that are critical for Th17 differentiation, including L17A and L17F, L17-2. Therefore, AMU inhibits Th17 differentiation by targeting these critical genes, not only L17A, to prevent generation of Th17 cells. Now on the right side, you could see those upregulated genes. Those genes are critical. Those are transcriptive factors critical for Th1, Th2, the Treg cells. It was unobserved by scientists. If you inhibit one Th cell, in this case, is the Th17 cell. There is reciprocal upregulation of other Th cells. So you see this upregulation Th1, Th2, Treg cell. This is from another point to confirm that AMU-935 specifically targets Th17 cells. So here, is we did RNA-seq and then we did we checked individual genes using RT-PCR just to confirm our RNA-seq analysis. This is confirmed L17A, L17F, and also other two specific Th17 genes are downregulated by AMU-935. And then we ask the question whether AMU targets those genes through our gamma T again perform RNA-seq analysis in the R-gamma-T knockout T-cell and the wild-type T-cell to identify R-gamma-T regulators. You can see those lists in here are the TH17 specific gene are down-regulated on the left one. You can see it in the R-gamma-T knockout T-cells. These same genes are downregulated by IMU-935, which is showing by the same color, blue. They are downregulated. This is confirmed that IMU-935 targets our gamma T regulated gene to control TH17 differentiation. Now, it is well known that our gamma T is a transcription factor, and the transcription factor regulates gene expression by binding to the gene promoter region and control their expression. Therefore, in here, we detected our gamma T DNA binding site genome-wide, and here the figure showing you is the R-gamma-T DNA binding site surrounded transcription starting site. Basically, it's believed the promoter region. In the R-gamma-T knockout T-cell, we couldn't detect a lot of signals. This is because they don't have R-gamma-T. And in the middle panel, you see that strong yellow signal that's showing you in the wild-type cell, R-gamma-T binding to the promoter region of about 3,000 genes. And with IMU-935, it significantly inhibited R-gamma-T ability to bind to the promoter region. You can see, compared with the wild-type, this is significantly reduced the binding. However, it's not totally eliminated. If you compare to the power gamma T deficient cell. On the right panel, I'm just showing you two specific examples on the IL-17A and the IL-17F locus. The top one is power gamma T deficient T cell. There's no power gamma T binding signal detected. Well, in the wild type, you can detect many peaks. This is showing the R-gamma-T binding peaks. With the IMU-935, we detect the same peak, but with significantly reduced signals. Here is the same for IL-17-23 receptor, which is another R-gamma-T target gene. And in the wild type, we detect the very good peaks. With IMU-935, you can see significantly reduced binding of our gamma T to this target gene also. So now we have the CHIP-seq and RNA-seq data. We cross-examine these two data to ask the question whether IMU-935 binding to their target gene and regulate their expression. So you can see that on the left panel, IMU, this is the CHIP-seq, reduced our gamma T binding, which is indicated by the blue, compared to the wild type without IMU-935. You see reduced signal means reduced our gamma T binding to these critical CHIP-seq genes. And on the right, you find out IMU also reduced their expression. So here is the mechanism how IMU-935 works. They impair R-gamma-T binding to those genes and reduce their expression. So after we confirm that IMU actually inhibits R-gamma-T function in TH17 cell, the next question is what happens? Does IMU-935 also affect our gamma T dependent chemotype development? And our gamma T, actually, we have shown that our gamma T is upregulated in this specific population of samoplasm. It's CD4 positive, CD8 positive. We call this double positive samoplasm. And enhance its survival. Therefore, we first tested, this is on the right panel, different concentration of IMU-935. Does it affect the survival of this population of simulcytes? You can see that those simulcytes with, without IMU-935 will survive very well. In contrast, our gamma T knockout mice undergo very fast cell death. This suggests that AMU actually does not affect our gamma T dependent simulcytes survival. And then we use a different way to test AMU on the simulcytes function. I mentioned that our gamma T is required for CD4, CD8, double positive cell survival. So if you take progenitor T cells from the thymus, from our gamma T knockout thymus, they don't divide into this population of double positive thymocytes. This is indicated by the red circle in here. If you could see that, this is in the red panel. And in contrast, wild type our gamma T progenitor T cells can differentiate into CD4 positive, CD8 positive, double positive samoplasm in the middle panel. With AMU-935, you can see this population cell also can also divide. This is means AMU-935 does not affect the development of this double positive population of cell. And we tested a different concentration. This is in the bottom panel, you can see that. They all do not affect the development of double positive samoplasm. Remember that when we use these concentrations of AMU-935, they potently inhibit our gamma T dependent Th17 differentiation. And then we receive more compounds. These are compounds from the our gamma T inhibitors from other pharmaceutical companies. We compared their ability to affect simulcytes survival. Again, I'm showing you on the top, you can see AMU-935 does not affect simulcytes survival, where the other three compounds listed here, here is the their published paper, they all accelerate simulcytes apoptosis, simulcytes death, just like our gamma T knockout. Actually, we tested more than these three compounds. We totally tested eight compounds from other pharmaceutical companies. They all promote simulcytes death. Only the AMU-935 does not affect simulcytes survival. And remember, we show you that AMU, this is on the left panel, AMU-935 in Th17 cell, they target our gamma T, target gene, critical Th17 gene. This will show you our gamma T deficient, and IMU treatment affects the same target gene, those Th17 gene, in the Th17 cell. However, in the simulcytes, when we use AMU-935, we also did a similar RNA-seq analysis. Those genes, those are the cell death gene and the cell cycle gene, they are not affected. They are similar to the wild type, but different from our gamma T deficient cell. This is, again, to show you AMU does not target our gamma T regulated gene in the simulcytes. So here is the summary of our results. We know that RFMP regulates both TH17 cell and the cytokine function. When either deleted RFMP or use AMU 935, we can affect TH17 function. However, AMU does not affect thymocyte function. We demonstrated this by different ways. In the TH17 cell, we show you AMU 935 inhibits TH17 differentiation, inhibits TH17 signature gene. This we didn't show you. We also analyzed AMU affected pathway. Those pathways are required for TH17 differentiation. However, AMU 935 does not affect thymocyte development. We show you that AMU 935 does not affect thymocyte development, does not induce thymocyte apoptosis, also does not affect expression of the gene critical for thymocyte function. I was asking myself why AMU is so specific, so different from the RGAMA T inhibitor from the other companies. I think from the beginning, Hila introduced that Immunic used a different way to screen RGAMA T inhibitor. Immunic screened out RGAMA T by its ability to inhibit IL-17 production. While most other companies use the traditional way, they screen out RGAMA T inhibitor by their ability to inhibit RGAMA T transcriptional activity, which actually expected to affect RGAMA T function both in TH17 and thymocyte. That's it. I'm done. If you have any questions, welcome to ask.
Thank you, Professor Thun, for this fantastic presentation of how IMU 935 inhibits RGAMA T dependent TH17 but not thymocyte function. We very much appreciate having you as a speaker on our call today. Thank you for being with us. And now I would
like
to open the webcast for our first Q&A session focusing on RGAMA T and Professor Thun's presentation. Cole, please proceed with the first set of questions.
Thank you. And we will now begin the question and answer session. To ask a question, you may press star then one on your touch-tone phone. If you're using a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before pressing the keys. To withdraw your question, please press star then two. And at this time, we'll pause momentarily to assemble the roster. And our first question will come from Yasmin Rahimi with Piper Sandler. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much for taking my questions. I just wanted to understand, during the presentation, it was commented on that IM935 was tested against eight other competitor programs, and it was noted that 935 is the only one that does not affect thermocyte development. Can you comment on how eight of the competitor programs, how does 935 magnitude and IL-17 inhibition compared to, how does it compare in inhibition of TH17 differentiation? So if you could just comment that, that would be helpful for us. And Dayton, I'll jump back into the queue.
Yeah, so first of all, we compared the inhibition for RGAMA T, and actually they were all in the same range, so it was all between 5 and 50 nanomolar IC50s on raw gamma T inhibition in the SCAL4 assay. And actually they're from, we have not tested all of the compounds against IM935 with regard to TH17 differentiation or IL-17 production, but the compounds we have tested, they were actually in a similar range for the inhibition of IL-17 production in the human PBMC assay.
Got it, thank you.
And so it really seems to be a different.
No,
fine.
Okay, go ahead,
please.
I was going to say, I just want to make sure that when you're referring to the 8 compounds tested, that those 8 compounds include the current 6 that are currently in development that you highlighted on slide 7 of your current deck.
Oh, good that you asked. This is not the case. We are currently in the process of synthesizing reference molecules which are in phase 2. So the molecule testing we started, and I think this was really the goal was to investigate why those programs stopped. So these are the 8 molecules of phase 2. These were really molecules which are no longer in development. And this was the first step. Of course, now we would like to see if other molecules which are now still in active development are more similar to what we see, or if they are different. And that's something which I'm excited to see maybe next couple of weeks. No data yet to show.
Got it. Thank you, Daniel. Thanks for the call.
And our next question will come from Govind Singh with JMP. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks. This was a really great introduction to RR gamma T. I guess maybe 2 for Dr. Sun. Can you help us understand a little bit more about 935 and how it's different to these 8 different compounds? Is it binding to another site on RR gamma T, and that's why it's still suppressing some of the transcriptions, but not as much as maybe some of these other competitors? I'm just trying to understand a little bit more granularity around the mechanism of action. And then just curious, with these other compounds, so the upregulation of Tregs that you use as FOXP3, is that like a byproduct of the lack of overstimulation, or is there something else being induced because of the interaction with 935 that's allowing that? Thank you.
Okay. So for L17 and the Treg, actually, it has been shown in many publications, they are reciprocal chains. So if you upregulate L17, you will observe downregulated Treg. If you upregulate Treg, you will see downregulated L17. So this is, they have a common link pathway, control them reciprocally. So our results showing that it's simply confirm that the IMU-935 actually inhibits IL-17. We don't have evidence it is direct, affect Treg, or indirect. And the second question, why IMU shows, compared to the other compound, they show different effect in TH17 and Thymosat. I think the simple answer is we don't know the answer yet. We are still working on it. But as I mentioned, that I think it starts with the way that MU935, how it is screened. I mentioned that it's screened by its ability to inhibit L17 production. Well, most other compounds, I know they screen use traditional reporter assay that basically inhibits all gamma T transcriptional activity. So that you would expect they will hit all gamma T transcriptional activity both in the TH17 cell and the seminal cell. I have a hypothesis how IMU works, but it's not proven. It may differentially affect protein-protein interaction. In the TH17 cell, it affects both protein-protein interaction critical for TH17. However, in the cytotype, they may not affect protein-protein interaction. Our gamma T interact with different proteins in the cytotype that are critical for cytotype function. So they may differentially affect our gamma T interacting. But we are working on it, but we don't have evidence so far yet to support it.
Thank you.
And our next question will come from Zegbe Jala with Roth Capital. Please go ahead.
Hello, thanks for taking my question. Really helpful presentation. Really like the fact at the end that you mentioned that Munich used a really unique screening method to rule out any effects on thymocytes, which I thought was really interesting. But just kind of wanted to follow up also on some of the AEs that we've seen with other RIP gamma inhibitors, particularly one from VK and I think Takeda as well. So I was just wondering if there are any additional screening methods put in to prevent some of the AEs that we've seen with other agents, specifically, for example, liver tox and things like that.
Pardon me, everyone. This is the operator speaking. The main speaker line has disconnected. Please hold while we retry to get them back online. One moment. And one moment, please, while we get the main speaker line connected again. Pardon me, everyone. I have reconnected the main speaker location, and apologies, but Segbe Jala, please go ahead with your question again.
Sure. I just wanted to follow up on my previous question, which was generally just asking about other things that you kind of developed against, meaning at the end of the last presentation, it was mentioned that you specifically avoided effects on thymocytes, just via your screening method that you use for the compound. And so I was just wondering how you went about, screening for an asset that could perhaps prevent some of the liver tox that we've seen with other RIP gamma inhibitors, and particularly, I think, VK and the Takeda's.
So actually, we haven't tested the VK molecule in this assay test system so far, and neither the Takeda one, actually.
That's true.
Yeah.
So maybe on that respect, I think that it's a different issue on finding selective molecules here. I think, first of all, an important piece of preventing effect in the liver is to avoid unspecificity on the receptors. And I think that was part of screening procedure in the model we can install. I think as we use IL-17 is driving pharmacology, but of course ensuring that we can, we don't see any unspecific binding to the neuro receptors. For maybe regarding detailed specific of the drug, there's nothing really broadly published, it's just a few of data available. I think it more looks like there was a little bit of a non-linear behavior which turned out to be a problem. We have not seen such a thing. We are also showing some clinical data and also human PK soon in the next part of the presentation. So far, these things, from my point of view, look really good.
Thanks, Daniel. Just a follow-up to that, because of the selectivity, we should just mention, does that mean that you didn't have to do anything that was restricted to the skin, which allows you to go after additional indications?
So actually, we are currently in phase 1 clinical trial, and actually, there's no sign that we should not go forward with anything. So actually everything's fine, and yes, we will go into other indications.
Thank you.
And our next question will come from Matt Catlin with Ladenburg Thalmann. Please go ahead.
Thank you for taking the questions. And just a quick follow-up on the prior question in terms of what indications do you think this target in terms of inhibition of IL-17 beyond psoriasis in terms of other immune indications that this that 935 could be interesting to use and to target?
Hi, Matt. This is Andreas. As you know, LORγ2 is basically one of the major components in terms of the inhibition of these cytokines that are responsible for a whole array of different autoimmune and chronic inflammatory diseases. So there, it could potentially have a very broad applicability. However, I think we have focused on psoriasis as a lead indication here because the proof of concept that IL-17 plays a very central role in the pathophysiology, I think, is very well shown. We have also published that we think that some of the neurodegenerative autoimmune diseases like Guillain-Barré or GBS, I think, could be affected as well. We think that's a good smaller indication, orphan indication, I think, where this is done. A predecessor molecule, we actually had very good data on lupus erythematosus and especially about lupus nephritis. So I think it just shows the very broad applicability of these war gamma inhibitors like IMU935. And at the moment, I don't think we have a special limitation here in terms of where it could apply. It's more the selection of where we think, I think we can show the value of this type of drug and proof of efficacy as quickly as possible. That's our goal here. And of course, we'll go into some other non-immunology but cancer indications later on in this call as well.
Okay, great. And then just a follow-up in terms of maybe Dr. Sung. He mentioned that the screening of 95 is unique. Does he know if the screening of the other compounds currently in development were done based on inhibition of IL-17 as well, similar to 935?
I actually don't know. But but since I know transcription factor and how they screen out because IL-17 is a nuclear receptor, the traditional way is use the reporter gene to screen compounds that can inhibit their transcriptional activity. So in that way, you screen the compound usually targeted to a specific region. It's called ligand binding region that totally inhibits this molecule's transcriptional activity. I don't know whether other companies screened it in a similar way that unique screened it. Maybe Hila and Dan knows.
Thanks, Dr. Sun, and thank you, Andrea.
No, thank you, Matt, and. So thank you very much, Professor Zunin-Zun. We very much appreciate your being here and presenting your results and answering these questions. And I'm Andreas Müller. I'm the Chief Medical Officer. I will go on with the presentation of the next section here, which is basically talking about the ongoing and the planned clinical development activities for IMU935. We first start with the ongoing phase 1 trial conducted in Australia. We had reported that this trial consists of three parts. Part A was the evaluation of a single dose, IMU935, in healthy volunteers. The dose escalation in this part A has been completed. but the data are still blinded given that a dose effect cohort is still ongoing. In this part A, IMU-935 or placebo was well tolerated, and the Safety Monitoring Committee has consistently recommended the dose escalation up to the highest planned dose. In part B, 14-day multiple dose treatment of IMU-935 is planned in healthy volunteers. The experimental part of the first cohort was already completed, and full data evaluation is still ongoing. However, this data will be used now to initiate also the first cohort of Part C. In Part C, psoriasis patients will be dosed with IMU-935 for 28 consecutive days. The start of this Part C is currently being prepared, and dosing is expected to start in the third quarter of this year. The initial data from this Part C are expected in second quarter of 2022. The phase 1 study of IMU-935 is designed using an adaptive transition between the different parts. This allows to initiate the first cohort in the next part while further dose escalation in the previous part is still ongoing. This enables a very efficient study design and transitions between the parts. This slide here summarizes the pharmacokinetic results of the different single-dose cohorts for the new lipid-free formulation of IMU-935. The data show a simple dose-linear pharmacokinetic with plasma concentrations consistently above the in vitro IC50 and IC90 values for inhibition of cytokines involved in autoimmune diseases. This pharmacokinetic profile makes IMU-935 suitable for once or twice daily use in multiple dosing. During the ongoing phase 1 trial and taking advantage of the temporary pause of phase 1 trials during the corona pandemic, we have transitioned from a lipid-based formulation to a new powder and capsule formulation. This provides improved pharmacological properties. The phase 1 trial had also shown that this new lipid-free formulation provided at least equivalent pharmacokinetic properties, and the development of IMU-935 will be continued using this improved formulation. Although the safety data for Part A are still blinded and the individual events cannot be yet attributed to treatment with IMU-935 or placebo, there was no indication of any safety signals in this phase 1 trial. There was no dose dependency in number or kind of adverse events. There were no systematic changes in laboratory findings, EKG findings, or vital signs. No maximum tolerated dose was reached at the end of the pre-planned dose escalation in this trial. This next slide summarizes the most common adverse events in this trial that are attributed to drug treatment. The adverse events recorded in this trial were mostly of general nature and no specific adverse event types generally attributable to the study drug was found. As indicated before, we are currently preparing this to start phase Part C with 28-day daily dosing in psoriasis patients, which will be started soon. This part of the phase 1 trial will evaluate moderate to severe psoriasis patients for safety, tolerability, pharmacokinetics, and exploratory activity. There will be two cohorts in this trial of Part C, a lower dose cohort to be started initially with 16 patients, and a second higher dose cohort of 36 patients to be started subsequently. Both cohorts will be randomized to IMU-935 and placebo in a 3-to-1 ratio. The Part C will enroll adult patients with pre-specified psoriasis disease scores that were developed together with expert dermatologists. All patients also had to have responded to at least one topical psoriasis therapy or are intolerant or have contraindications to them. The primary objective for Part D is safety and tolerability in psoriasis patients. However, this study will also record the effect on skin symptoms, including the effect on PASI score, as well as looking at biomarkers and other pharmacodynamic readouts. I would like to transition now to present our new and exciting results regarding preclinical anti-cancer activity of IMU-935. But before our team and Hella dives into the data, let me provide you a short introduction to castration-resistant prostate cancer. Prostate cancer is one of the most prevalent cancer types in men. Early treatment with androgen deprivation therapy often provides long initial phases of tumor control. However, over time, the prostate cancer regularly escapes the control of testosterone-lowering therapies and then shows progression and or more potential for distant metastases. This stage of the disease where testosterone-lowering therapy loses effectiveness is then called castration-resistant prostate cancer, or CRPC. CRPC creates new therapeutic challenges. There are limited therapeutic options available for CRPC. Taxol-derived chemotherapies, abiraterone and enzalutamide, both therapies targeting the androgen receptor, as well as radioactive treatments targeting bone metastases, are approved for different settings in CRPC. The therapy guidelines in CRPC also specifically address when the treatment with androgen receptor medications become less responsive. This quite regularly occurs when the mutant variant ARV7 of the androgen receptor becomes more dominant. This ARV7 variant lacks the androgen ligand binding domain, which is the target of enzalutamide or abiraterone, but remains constitutively active during tumor progression. The transition from wild-type androgen receptor to this mutant variant ARV7 becomes a great therapeutic challenge, and new therapies that are effective in ARV7 dominant tumor progressions are desperately needed. With this introduction, I would like to hand over to Hella, our Chief Scientific Officer, for the presentation of the exciting preclinical data of IMU-935 in this setting.
Thank you. So as we heard from Andreas, new treatment options targeting the mutated variant of the androgen receptor are needed. Since inhibiting the activity of the androgen receptor by inhibitors is no longer an option to treat these tumors, reducing the expression seems to be a path forward. As published in 2016, raw gamma drives the androgen receptor expression for the wild-type and mutated variant E7. And therefore could be a good target for pharmacological intervention. With IMU-935 targeting the ligand binding domain of both raw gamma and raw gamma T, we think that we can provide a treatment option for castration-resistant prostate cancer. First, IMU-935 represses the mutated androgen receptor ARV7 expression and subsequent tyrosine. Second, IMU-935 inhibits the secretion of IL-17, which itself contributes to the formation, growth, and the metastasis of cancer, because IL-17 induces mitogenic signaling. Third, IMU-935 has a double impact on so-called MDSC, myeloid-derived suppressor cells, which are tumor-promoting cells. As IL-17 mediates the induction, recruitment, and expansion of MDSC, IMU-935 is thought to be able to suppress this recruitment. In addition, differentiation induction of these tumor-promoting cells by IMU-935 makes them less tumor-supportive. IMU-935 demonstrated raw gamma-dependent effects in CRPC cells in vitro. For mutated E7-positive cancer cells, the inhibition of AR signaling by enzalutamide or other androgen axis targeted therapy is no longer feasible due to the loss of the ligand binding part of the androgen receptor. ARV7 cancer cells receive constant on signal from the androgen receptor for targeting driving tumor progression. Therefore, repression of the V7 androgen receptor protein is needed to block signaling in these tumors. On the left, we show that IMU-935 is able to repress ARV7 on mRNA level as well as on protein level. In addition, it can be seen that IU935 is much more potent on both RNA and protein repression compared to the raw gamma induced agonist used in the before-mentioned publication. This repression of ARV7 protein expression by IU935 can be translated into antiproliferative effects of different prostate cancer cell lines, as shown on the right. Enzalutamide is ineffective on most cell lines, whereas IU935 is highly potent on most of them, with IC50 values in the low nanomolar range. With this, I would like to hand over to Andrea, who is the medical officer, who will present the planned phase 1 study in castration-resistant prostate cancer.
So I'm very happy now to explore a little bit the use of IU935 for the first time in patients with castration-resistant prostate cancer. First of all, our entire team is very excited that one of the most well-known experts in the world regarding castration-resistant prostate cancer has joined forces to work with Munich, as well as recognizes the unique mechanism of action that IU935 provides for this disease, in particular being potentially active in the setting of ARV7 predominant prostate cancers. Professor Bohm has also agreed to be the principal investigator of this trial, and his site will be the prime location for this trial. The involvement of Professor de Bono will also provide the highest possible visibility in the scientific and clinical community for Immunic's IU935, as he has been very tightly involved in the development of several other therapeutic approaches for prostate cancer. This phase 1 trial will be an open-label trial investigating dose escalation of IU935 in metastatic CRPC. The study follows a Bayesian design that incorporates information of previous cohort results into decisions for further dose escalation, allowing an efficient study progress. Following the dose escalation, when a therapeutically active dose level has been observed, an extension cohort can potentially be added, providing more extensive activity data later on. Our team is currently preparing the study, and dosing this trial is expected to start in the fourth quarter of this year. This is a general outline of the design of our phase 1 study of IU935 and CRPC. Each dose escalation cohort will consist of at least 6, but no more than 9 CRPC patients. After the first treatment cycle of 28 days, a safety analysis will assess the predefined rules for dose limiting toxicity and whether a new dose cohort can be started. However, the patients will continue their main treatment of 3 treatment cycles of 28 days each. After this, an interim analysis of the cohort will be conducted that includes biochemical response on PSA, effect on circulating tumor cells, and medical imaging results. CRPC patients that receive a benefit from IU935 are able to extend treatment beyond this initial treatment period. The main cohort analysis will be performed when the last patient in treatment reaches the 6-month follow-up visit. This study design also enables to receive safety and activity data from IU935 throughout the ongoing trial. This study will enroll patients with confirmed prostate cancer that have shown progressive disease according to the Prostate Cancer Working Group 3 criteria. Patients also have to show castration-resistant disease as well as presence of metastatic disease. The primary objective of this trial is to explore the presence of and escalation to a dose-limiting toxicity for IU935 in this patient population, but also to investigate a potential phase 2 dose based on safety and activity criteria. The study will explore response in terms of prostate-specific antigen, circulating tumor, as well as based on imaging criteria. In addition, specific biomarkers will also be investigated. With this very short introduction into the design of the phase 1 trial in metastatic CRPC, I will hand over again to the moderator to open another question and answer section in this call, please.
Thank you. And once again, we will begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touchtone phone. If you're using a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before pressing the keys. If you would like to withdraw your question, please press star then two. And one moment, please, for the first question. And our first question today will come from Ram Selvaraju with H.C. Wainwright. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Gopalan dialing in for Ram Selvaraju, and thanks for taking my question. So just to clarify, so you said three doses will be tested before reaching the recommended phase two dose. Is that right?
We have not necessarily pre-specified how many doses. We think that three doses probably gets us close to a recommended phase two dose, but there's no limitation on the number of doses to describe.
Got it. So what are your preliminary thoughts on dose-limiting toxicity for IMU-935, given the preclinical data?
I think so far from what we have seen, both from the animal tox data and from the phase one studies, so far we have really no understanding what the critical toxicity is, to be quite honest. So I think we're prepared to nothing and anything that comes, more or less.
Got it. So you mentioned that IMU-935 will be developed as a treatment option for progressive metastatic CRPC patients. So I'm just curious if you could clarify a little bit more on the definition of progressive mCRPC and what the prior treatment continuum would look like in this patient population.
So I think, like I said, I think there's a prostate cancer working group three that has defined the criteria for progression in this patient population. And basically, there is three different conditions that can lead to the definition of progression. That's, first of all, a PSA, a biochemical progression. That's usually when you have more than 2.7 milligrams per milliliter of PSA, but you also have to have at least a 25% increase from nadir. That's basically the lowest PSA value that you had under treatment, mostly with androgen receptor therapies. And then if you have an increase of PSA during these androgen receptor therapies, that's usually what's called progression. The other way could be that you have an increase in circulating tumor cells, and that's usually it's more than 5 tumor cells in 7.5 milliliters of blood. If you have more than 5 tumor cells, you'll consider this also a progression if that is a new finding. And then, of course, in terms of imaging, you have the presence of new local, distant metastases, either lymph nodes or bone or other tissues, that's also considered progression. So these are the three definitions of progression according to prostate cancer working group three.
All right, one final question from me. So given the treatment landscape for the prostate cancer, what agents might IMU-935 be most likely to compete against or complement? And also, would IMU-935 be assessed in chemotherapy experience as well as chemotherapy naive patients in your upcoming trial? Thank you.
So I think for this trial, we take chemotherapy naive patients for now. However, I think you also ask a good question in terms of what do we complement or what do we compete with. And in a lot of ways, I think the two androgen receptor therapies, abiraterone and enzalutamide, these are the ones that are usually given before you go to Taxol chemotherapy because you hope that you still use the androgen receptor therapy to keep prostate cancer in under control, basically. And this is, I think, my personal hypothesis, I think, would be that very likely if you see, for example, a biochemical progression in terms of PSA under these treatments, that you either shift to or add IMU-935 to these therapies in the future. But I think this is, at this point, this is just speculation. I think we have to explore a little bit more of the characteristics of the treatment effect of IMU-935 in this trial, day-to-day, show that there is one. I think this is our first step here.
Thanks for taking my question. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you.
And our next question will come from Thomas Smith with SVB Leerink. Please go ahead.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking the questions and for the really helpful overview. Just on the 935 initial phase 1 data, obviously you'll learn a lot more from the multiple dose data, but at this point, how are you thinking about the profile here in terms of dosing frequency? Are you thinking once daily, twice daily, just based on, I guess, the initial phase 1 healthy volunteer data?
So I think the first cohort that we have done in MAD was done with once daily administration. So that's, I think, what was the initial reaction we had when we saw the Part A single dose pharmacokinetic data. There is a possibility of maybe going to twice daily, but I think both would be possible with such pharmacokinetics. And you have seen probably the plasma half-life data that are somewhere between 20 and 26 hours. So I think if you look at these kind of plasma half-lives, both one or twice daily, I think it should be possible. It depends a little bit, I think, also on what kind of profile do you want necessarily, whether you have a more stable profile that sometimes and avoid some of the Cmax values, then you go to a twice daily approach. We have not seen, as I described, any indication of any safety signals here, so that's why I think this may not play as much of a role, that we avoid these large maximum concentration Tmax values. So I think once daily is still absolutely possible, and given that this would be a profile that has a larger difference between Tmax and trough levels 24 hours later, but I think both are possible down the road. I think what we're doing now is dose escalation with multiple treatment in Part D with healthy volunteers, and I think this dose escalation there, I think, will tell us a little bit more also about the maybe the best profile once or twice daily, and I think we will probably test both in the MAD part and then decide what the most appropriate profile is for this part in the future, but both are possible from the PK.
Okay, got it. And then it'd be helpful just to get your sense of, I guess, your expectations from the Part C proof of concept data set in psoriasis patients that we're going to get here in Q2. What would you consider a strong data readout here?
So I think I'm cheating a little bit because we have the VJ data. All of us know the VJ data. And you know the VJ data as well, that's basically shown for the VJ molecule that with a 28-day treatment, you are able to see difference in the PASI scores already between a raw gamma treated and a placebo treated cohort. And that's, I think, what we would be striving for, to show this. And we are with the first cohort, what I call the lower dose cohort, we are already well within the therapeutic range, we believe, so that we actually believe that already with the low dose cohort, we can already see potentially these differential results of PASI score within the first 28 days. However, we also have the protocol set up so that we have a higher dose cohort than subsequently, which I think allows us also to understandable that the dose response curve for planning phase 2 trials down the road, and also make sure that we have really an understanding of where we are in terms of the therapeutic dose range for this disease, for psoriasis. But and then, of course, we would like to show that the 28-day treatment in psoriasis patients is safe and provides no limitations in terms of toxicity, which we hope to show as well. But that, I think, for the second quarter next year, we hope to show some initial data for differential PASI score and safety.
Okay, got it. Thanks for taking the question, Seth.
Thanks, Tom.
And our next question will come from Andreas Argyrides with Wedbush Securities. Please go ahead.
Thank you for taking your question. This is Andreas Ansalan with Zappos. And likewise, let me share my sentiments on a very comprehensive presentation. So regarding safety, for the psoriasis phase 1 study and based on the PK results of the two oral formulations, what are your expectations for the safety profile going forward with the new powder formulation?
So I think if I understood this well, Andreas, you wanted to talk a little bit about the two formulations and going forward, whether we have any safety expectations in terms of the new formulation. I think one of the things, of course, is with this drug that initially we had this lipid-based formulation, which maybe in terms of pharmacologic production and also some of the properties may not be ideal going forward, and also expanding trials and populations and so forth and doses. So that's why I think it was very important to us to have used that short pause that COVID provided to us for introducing this lipid-free formulation that actually is powder in a capsule, which I think we hadn't seen much, to be quite honest, with the old formulation, but I think definitely the absence of the lipids will allow us to go higher in doses, dosing, for example. I think when we talk about, for example, the CRPC indication, I think it's probably crucial to have a lipid-free formulation. And with that, I think we can escalate doses much higher with this lipid-free formulation. It allows us really to go to much, much higher doses in cancer patients than we would ever do in psoriasis patients or any other autoimmune or immunological disease.
Okay, thank you.
I hope I understood your question correctly, Andrea.
Yeah, no, that's thanks for the call on the formulation. I'll just jump back in the queue. Thank you.
Okay.
And our next question will come from Zegbeh Jallah with Roth Capital. Please go ahead.
Thanks for taking another of my questions. This one is about the prostate cancer question. And just kind of wanted to get a general sense of what you're thinking about durability, meaning, you know, how long do you think patients are going to be able to stay on your drug for? And is it likely that it could also be effective against other mutations beyond the one you just noted?
So I think it's very difficult to answer really. I think you get this mutation, and the mutation becomes important, this ARV7 mutation and this variant, because you're treating with androgen receptor therapies, and then basically this mutation just gets rid of the ligand binding domain. So it basically puts the androgen receptor on auto excitement mode, more or less, yes, without any possibility for external influence by drugs that bind to the androgen receptor. And I think what Hella showed, and I'm probably the worst person to talk about these data, is that I think we're interfering with the effects of this androgen receptor on a molecular level, on mRNA and on protein that is affected down the road from the receptor. So I think we're affecting more the effect size of this androgen receptor rather than the ligand binding site, which I think makes this a little bit more harder for the cell, the cancer cell, probably to develop mutations. Cancer usually is quite smart, there are surprises, and cancer is very polyclonal, and once you do an intervention that's effective, suddenly a clone that is not affected by this intervention can become dominant. So I think this is something that we probably have to monitor. But for now, I think this very prominent, very well-known mutation of the androgen receptor, the ARV7, I think it's definitely something that we can deal with, and that's usually what happens. And these androgen receptor therapies will stay the mainstay of treatment in prostate cancer for a long period of time. So that's my prediction. So this mutation will pop up over and over again, and because I think the androgen receptor has this really often like 10-year possibility of a very easy treatment to keep the prostate cancer really under control, and that's really given that most patients with prostate cancer are relatively old, is often enough time to think about other treatment options and so forth. So I think I expect that the ARV7 is something that we need to deal with in the future and continue to deal with in the future, but it's very hard to predict how smart cancer will be to get around whatever intervention comes down the road.
Thanks, Andreas. And then just to confirm, I think you did say that after you guys get this initial single agent data that you will be exploring, or you will be open at least to combo efficacy as well as looking at earlier lines of therapy.
Exactly. Come again. I'm not sure. We have single dose in part A. Part B is multiple dose in healthy volunteer. Part C is the multiple dose 28 days in psoriasis patients. What are you referring to? Maybe I missed the question. Sorry, Becker.
It's okay. For the prostate cancer program, just to confirm that after you get the initial data, that you are going to be open to looking at combo agents and then also looking perhaps at earlier lines of therapy.
You mean in prostate cancer, yes?
Yes, correct.
Yes. So I think, yes, I think this is something that, I think, first of all, I think we need to confirm the anti-tumor activity in vivo in this trial in patients. So I think that's the main drive here. And yes, I think down the road, I think I gave you my hypothesis how it's used in the future, and I could very well see that we might put it in combination, for example, with androgen receptor therapy, to avoid maybe also going into this situation where the ARV7 is dominant. But I think this is down the road. And I think there's a lot to be done in terms of the how to position this and see how this works. And there's a lot of preclinical work, by the way, underway, also with Professor De Bono, that looks at the specific mechanism of action, how cancer cells react, how cancer stem cells react, and also how this could be done potentially, where there are synergistic effects. I think it's probably a little bit too early to make a firm statement here what would work best clinically. I think there's a lot of preclinical work that is going in parallel to this phase one dose escalation study that we're performing now.
Thanks, Andreas. Really exciting. Looking forward to the data.
Thank you, Douglas.
And once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star then one. And our next question will come from Yasmeen Rahimi with Piper Sandler. Please go ahead.
Hey, team. I have a number of questions for you. I'm going to go one by one. So the first question for you is, what is the highest dose you tested in your multiple ascending dose? And then how does that compare to the current ROR inhibitors? What fold higher were you able to move forward? And I have a couple of follow-ups.
So we haven't disclosed the dose yet that we used in MAD, but we believe that it's in a therapeutically active range, because I think we're well above that's what we showed basically in the SAD as well. We're well above the EC50 and EC90. But for now, I think let us please escalate the dose a little bit, and then we'll talk a little bit more about the dose range, please.
Got it. Thank you, Andreas. And let me ask a different question. So in your SAP study, you went up to 400 milligram dose groups. So maybe how does that range of 100 to 400 compared to other RORs that are currently in development, just staff to staff comparison?
You would have to look at the EC50 and EC90, so it's probably not a question that I can answer very easily, to be quite honest. Yes. I'm sorry. I'm the guy driving the clinical program here. I'm the monkey doing clinical for us here.
Maybe
one more comment. I think usually this data is hidden by companies. Not everybody's as open as we are, for example, today, show everything. So, for example, some competitive projects, a bigger pharma company, there's no data available about details of PK right now, even if they know in phase two. But I think we try to make smart decisions here, and I think looking at our EC90 values, our EC90 values for the cytokine cell function, I think we have, our feeling is that we are already in the active range with the lower of the SAE, and therefore I think we believe there will be, we expect them to a certain wide therapeutic window for the work. And that's all just based on our own data and not really from comparing that with others, which we just don't have.
Thank you, Ed. And yes, do a great job being very transparent. Another question for you is, I would like to drill down, you know, obviously one of the key endpoints and the one C will be the PCI. So at day 28, can you just remind us of the ranges of PCI versus the delta difference to placebo that we have seen? I know you alluded to that, but if you could just repeat that one more time, that would be great.
So I think you're referring to what we have seen as the example in the DK pharmaceutical phase one? Is that what you're asking here?
Yeah. I just want to have an understanding of what is the range of PCI improvement over placebo in day 28 with other ROR inhibitors.
Yeah. So I think what's seen with DK, DK did 28-day dosing. They did the PASI score every week. And they had, like I said, I think a placebo and a treatment group. They did not use a PASI 50 or PASI 70 score. So they're not looking at the proportion of patients that passed a certain threshold. So that's why, and also their published data just looked at the mean PASI scores over time. And they basically did an analysis of that there was a statistically significant decrease of the average PASI score using the ROR gamma inhibitor versus placebo. So it's very hard to say. There's not that I can say this is like 50% of patients reach PASI 75 or something like that. That was never published, that analysis was never done to my mind by DK. And that's also, I think, a little bit more difficult because most of the psoriasis studies, they wait for 3 or 6 months to analyze the PASI scores. And then you get a whole lot more of patients that reach those. And in the DK trial as well, more or less when you look at the data, you have the PASI of placebo and the ROR gamma inhibitor go very close to each other until week 3, and then it really separated thereafter. So I think very likely from at least the VK data, you need the 4 weeks, and you really have to expect something to happen more or less just before the 28 days. However, I think we also know from the VK molecule that their PK was very short, if I remember, 3 or 4 hours, and they had 3 times a day dosing, which meant that their coverage of time over their IC50 or IC90, whatever threshold you want to put on, was maybe shorter than expected, and that's why also I think it was something that maybe improved with a drug like INU935 that has a much more stable pharmacokinetic profile that allows really a more or less more stable pattern of ROR gamma inhibition over time during the day, and not that basically on-off
alternating like DK, but this is also all speculating on my part whether that would lead to an improved, I think, performance of Party.
Thank you for the call, Andrea. Maybe a last question is, thank you for highlighting, you know, why prostate cancer could be an indication to move forward. But I think what would be helpful to understand it is, and the preclinical data is very compelling, but why that indication maybe versus other opportunities that are on the table?
That's a good question. Sometimes you have to sit here as a management team and have to make hard decisions. And sometimes it's not easy because, first of all, we love all our children and we love a lot of different indications. We have good data also for 935 in different settings. But we are here because we have to focus the company on what we consider the best opportunity for this drug to show its effect and its activity, and to do this in the most efficient way to show proof of efficacy. And sometimes these are very difficult decisions, and that this definitely was a very difficult decision that we said, well, probably psoriasis is absolutely crucial, I think, for Rokama because of the data with the antibodies in psoriasis, but also because of the DK pharmaceutical data. And that I think it's very crucial that we do the same, go the same development route so that you also as an analyst or as an observer can compare this to the DK molecule, which is kind of the standard, even so with discontinued later on for safety, but it's the standard for psoriasis efficacy. And then I think we had also indicated that we had other ideas for an orphan disease, and this is not that we have abandoned it. This is something where we believe that I think, given the data where we are, given the clinical needs, given also the lack of therapeutic options in this very prevalent cancer, and the high need to develop new therapies for this ARV7 situation, and given the preclinical data, that very compelling clinical data that we have exactly in that ARV7, we decided that this is the best way to move forward. On top of it, I think it allows us to really, I think, escalate the doses much further from what we would have done in maybe a non-cancer setting to really also show the potential large safety window that we have with RMN-935. But that's another probably consideration on our side. But sometimes these are difficult decisions to be made by the team here.
Well, maybe if I could add maybe something here, Daniel. I think from my point of view, looking back how we approached that, because I think it was prostate cancer channel would be one of the biggest unmet need results in that range. And we spoke to really many experts. And we as a company were quite convinced that this is an opportunity which we need to evaluate. I think from the ethical, scientific, and medical point of view, I think this is my indication is really, really standing out. And really, I think we can that this is the right step to explore the potential. And also in the discussions with the experts, and finally with Johan de Bona, I think he was also very excited about going forward and also coming together on the idea of how to do that. We are going to have really a wonderful program together, not only just the top line working on safety, phase one in these patients, but also really have an in-depth view on biomarkers, which really may guide us forward and maybe that ends up in really one of the biggest developments for such communication.
Thank you.
And our next question will come from Matt Catlin with Ladenburg Thalmann. Please go ahead.
Thank you. I guess a follow-up for Andreas. Based on the SAD and MAD data that you already have in hand, how do you think the dosing in the prostate cancer setting versus the autoimmune indications will differ? Will it be vastly different from what you see so far?
This is speculation, but I think in our discussion with also Johan de Bono and other prostate cancer experts, I think they were very keen to go to as high as possible doses with this drug. So I think in the SAD and MAD part in our phase one study in Australia, we knew about that we very likely won't hit dose limiting toxicity based on the animal tox data and how this translates into human concentration. So we actually planned the phase one trial to dose the effects, to dose into the therapeutic range, and then be able to do, for example, this part C, where we show that this dose range is already therapeutically active without really having dose-limiting toxicity. I think here with prostate cancer, we are challenged by urologists and oncologists really to explore the dose-limiting toxicity, which means I think we'll probably the effect of 4 or higher, or even 8 higher than the likely therapeutic dose in chemotherapy.
Thanks,
Matt.
And our next question will come from Govind Singh with JMP. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks. Wanted to follow up on a few of the previous questions. So I'd be curious to know, what was the stimulus that you guys made you guys want to make this lipid-free 935? And can you just remind me really quickly, was the preclinical data at the start of the presentation that we saw today, was that using the lipid-free version or the prior version? And then one follow-up after that.
So actually the early animal tox data were performed in dogs, were performed with a lipid-based formulation, whereas the 3-month tox data in dogs were performed with the colline and capsule.
But the in vitro experiments were suggested the API in the formulation, because in vitro you generated.
And the reason for why you guys wanted to create a lipid-free?
So I think the drive is really, once you go into higher doses, this lipid-free formulation is much better in dose density. So meaning that if you go to higher doses, a lipid formulation would require that you swallow 4 or 8 capsules per day for higher doses, especially that's why I said, I think if you want to go into, for example, prostate cancer formulation, where I think the lipid-free formulation is a much dose-dense formulation, so I think you can pack a lot more of the API into a powder and capsule formulation than a lipid-based formulation. That was one of the considerations, but there was also on the pharmacological side, I think, in terms of how you solve and how you store and so forth. But I think from my point of view, from the clinical point of view, I love the lipid-free formulation, powder in the capsule, because it's very dose-dense. So I think you need basically one capsule wherever you go with the dose.
I see. And then that's great. And then for the to prostate cancer, you guys showed some really nice data with the mutant AR-7 and how you're reducing mRNA levels in protein. What is the, have you guys looked at wild type? Is this a specific effect for ARV7, or are you also, having this effect on wild type? Is it more on wild type than ARV7? Just trying to tease that out.
Yeah, so actually we have looked for wild type and for the V7, and we see a similar effect here. Because it is that inhibition of raw gamma as a transcription factor drives the transcription of wild type and ARV7. So we have a similar effect here.
Great, thank you.
But targeting the V7 variant is much more important here for prostate cancer.
And this will conclude our question and answer session. I'd like to turn the conference back over to Daniel for any closing remarks.
Yeah, thank you. And first of all, thank you all of you for asking these broad questions. And I hope you can feel our excitement around psoriasis now starting. I think just to remind everybody about the selectivity we found and Professor Sun found in his studies on the specific effects. But let me close this presentation just to summarize in key hallmarks of the molecule. So first of all, I'm 95 is a potent programmer T inhibitor or inverse agonist with a cellular inhibition in the low nanomolar range. The molecule demonstrated the selective effect on inhibition of Th17 differentiation while maintaining physiological function of thymocyte maturation. The molecule is currently tested in a phase 1 clinical trial, which is planned to be expanded to patients with moderate to severe disease during already this quarter. In the first single ascending dose part of the phase 1 trial, IU95 demonstrated suitable pharmacokinetic properties. A new clinical phase 1 trial in patients with castration-resistant prostate cancer is expected to start in the fourth quarter of this year, with Professor Johan de Bono as principal investigator. And first in the efficacy data for psoriasis patients is expected to be available in the second quarter of next year. Yeah, with this, I think I would like to once again thank you for dialing in, for listening, for a lively discussion. I would like to conclude today on the update from UNH. My special thanks once again go to Professor Simonson for and his team. It's such a big pleasure working with you on the forefront of vitamin C biology. We're looking forward to continuing our efforts on executing and expanding our clinical trial program for 95 and deepening also our understanding how that new molecule actually works. And with that, thank you all and goodbye.
Ladies and gentlemen, the conference has now concluded. Thank you for attending today's presentation. You may now disconnect your lines at this time.